The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
What is a phladry?
Phladry is a tool that we use to try to protect our cattle from wolves. It's basically just a little strand of nylon, almost like baling twine, with flags hanging from it every foot and a half or 2 feet or so. And those flags move in the wind, and supposedly they produce an effect that kind of deters the wolves. It's also a tremendous annoyance if you have a lot of wind and a lot of little flags twisted up with each other.
Welcome to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman. This is a program that features authors from the Western U.S., and I'm talking this time with Bryce Andrews, who spent a year working on the Sun Ranch in southwest Montana, then wrote a memoir about it titled Bad Luck Way. So let's begin with the condensed version of your life before you started working at the Sun Ranch in the spring of 2006. Where did you grow up and what brought you to Montana?
Well, I was born and raised in Seattle, Washington, and was actually raised in the urban heart of Seattle, you know, about as far socially as one could get from the place where I've chosen to live. My father ran the University of Washington's Art Museum for most of my childhood, and my mom is a professional photographer. So I grew up in the art world in Seattle. And even as a kid, I developed this incredible curiosity about the West, at least the West as I understood it, from a great remove. And somehow I knew that the West existed east of Seattle, oddly enough. And I remember as a kid, my dad helped to organize a show called The Myth of the West at the Henry Gallery, the University of Washington's Art Museum. And I remember standing in front of these, you know, these sort of artifacts from a very different place and looking at the quality of the light, looking at the people, and just seeing it as different and being really drawn to it. So I came to stay for the first time just after college. I found this job through the Montana State University Range Sciences Department. Found this little job that said a grazing technician on the Sun Ranch. And so I moved to Montana and really gave it a whirl.
You had a little bit of ranching experience before that, though.
I did. I absolutely did. As I said, I was raised in Seattle, but I did come to Montana. My parents had two really good friends, the Zentses, the Zents family. And Patrick Zents, the dad in that family, is a sculptor and a third-generation rancher outside Billings. I remember going out there, and they indulged me by letting me help them with work on their place. The most, you know, the most menial, the hardest things to screw up were the ones they let me do. So I'd roll up barbed wire, I'd, you know, fix fence, or I'd help them a little bit with the cattle. And there was something about that that really resonated with me, being able to see the effects of what I had done on the landscape and feeling as though I was living a more complete life from interacting with the natural world. I loved that, and that's what sent me toward the Sun Ranch, and that's what made me, you know, fight to get that job.
Billings is in the eastern part of Montana, so tell us where the Sun Ranch is located and what's around it. What does that country look like?
Well, it's stunning country. You know, it's in southwest Montana. It's at the very upper end of the Madison Valley, just off the northwest corner of Yellowstone Park. So it's high country, it's cold, it's open, and there's an austerity about the landscape that really struck me. Because, you know, growing up in Seattle, you live in a world that is wet and is claustrophobic, but it's also really fertile. You know, it's a landscape that holds you close and kind of nurtures you and grows you. And you know, if you heal an apple core into the ground, you really expect that it will grow. And the Madison is not like that. The Madison is dry, and as I said, it's cold, and only the toughest things can live there. And so when I first got there, it was a striking contrast to what I'd known, and a very challenging place to think about making a life.
prime wolf country, as we'll talk about in a minute. But first, describe what sorts of responsibilities you had there. What was a typical day like for you?
Well, the wonderful thing about ranching is that most days are different. You know, that's what I've always really liked about it. The fact that you might be asked to do some weird thing you've never had a crack at before. But most of my days included, toward the beginning, they included a lot of fencing, you know, perhaps enough fencing to last some people a lifetime. And, you know, the fencing took me to all different corners of the ranch, which was an incredible thing. You know, you really don't know how elk and deer and other animals use a landscape until you fix all the places where they break a fence. And so you it's odd because it's difficult work, and you spend a lot of time staring at two wires that you really wish were just one wire. But at the same time, you see a lot. You see different corners. So that was part of the work. And once the cattle arrived, because we grazed seasonally, it was such high country that we'd bring cattle on in the spring and graze them through the fall. Once the cattle arrived, most of my life revolved around caring for them, making sure they had water, setting out salt, herding them from place to place, because we really embraced a conservation ethic with our ranching on that place. We were trying to use the cattle in the role of native grazers. We were trying to move them across the land in a way that improved the landscape rather than destroyed it.
Yeah, back to that water that you mentioned. The Sun Ranch had a very complex water delivery system.
Well, we had large herds of cattle on the place. There were about 1,400 steers and heifers that we were grazing. And, you know, each one of those animals drinks a large quantity of water, you know, pushing 10 gallons on a hot day. And so our delivery system for water involved two of these huge cisterns on hillsides and wells that served them, and each well was run by a generator. So each morning, and sometimes each night as well, you'd have to go and fuel the generator and service it and make sure that it could pull enough water out to keep up with the demand. We did have creeks on the ranch. You know, we could have watered out of those creeks, but the history on that place, you know, the deep history on the place was one of overgrazing along those creeks, and so the water system was designed to allow us to better move the cattle around the property and to kind of minimize the destructive influence on the creeks.
Because the cattle would go down to the creek and drink and then foul the water, and then the banks would cave in and...
Sure. Yeah, and it's hard to blame them. I mean, it, you know, they're these lush, beautiful green areas, and you know, the cattle that we were mostly running are British breeds. You know, they were bred and developed in these areas that were lush and full of moisture, and it's hard to ask a cow like that to go and walk a mile between where they water and where they eat. They'd much rather do it in the same place.
Sure. But I guess I ask you to explain that because it is part of the lengths to which the ranch owner, Roger, at the time, who had lots of money and was interested in good conservation for the land and the animals, he went to great lengths, including building that big water system to try to balance things out, and yet ultimately he didn't make it. And it's the issue of trying to conserve land and make money is so complex.
Yeah. Yeah, it's incredibly complex, and it's, you know, you're keying into a really important thing, because, you know, that was an interesting place, the Sun Ranch, because we were doing some pretty successful conservation ranching, which is to say we were doing it on a large scale and we're actually doing well by the land. There was a guest ranch, an ecotourism operation. There was a hunting outfitting business. And all of that still didn't let the ranch pencil out. And the big thing that drives that is a larger issue. It's the ongoing crowding of our landscapes and the fierce desire of people who are not too dissimilar from me, who come from other places and really want to be here. You know, we've driven the cost of these beautiful open places up so far that it's awfully hard to make them pay for themselves through sustainable agriculture and even that plus a number of other, you know, different businesses.
We'll have to save the breaking up of the ecosystem and the effect it has on the animals and the land for another conversation some other day. But as you mentioned, selling grazing rights to other people for their cattle was part of how the ranch made money. And once those cattle arrived on your land, the land where you were working, you were responsible for their welfare and their safety and well-being, which you write about in a passage that I'd like you to read.
We spread the cattle across the ranch according to our grazing plan. There were two large herds, one of 680 steers and the other of 790 heifers. Both belonged to Orville Scogan. In addition to the yearlings, we pastured 200 cow-calf pairs from a family ranch down by Ennis. Once I talked with the matriarch of that family, a silver-haired, no-bullshit woman, when she came to drop off her cattle. She was on horseback, and I was afoot, and somehow we got started on the subject of wolves. She had heard rumblings about the new incarnation of the Taylor Peak Pack, now called the Wedge Pack, which sounded like trouble. "How do you figure," she asked, "to keep them out of my cattle?" I told her, as Jeremy had so often told me, that we were going to do everything in our power to keep the worst from happening. "We would patrol the herd diligently," I said, "and track the collared wolves in the pack with a telemetry system on loan from the University of Montana. When the two groups of animals got too close together, we would haze the wolves back into the wilderness and sleep out beside the cattle." I went on, warming to my task. We had non-lethal shotgun loads, cracker shells and rubber bullets. We had an experimental contraption called flagery, a one-string fence of twine and plastic flagging that was thought to frighten wolves. When her cows and calves moved into the riskiest places, we would ring their pasture with flagery and monitor the results. The hope, I told her, was to keep the cattle safe and learn something new about coexisting with predators. She took this in, listening with her mouth set in a grim line. When I finished talking, she let the silence hang long between us. Finally, she spoke. "You're going to put a string of flags around the cows?" "That was the plan," I said. "How does that keep the wolves out?" I confessed that I didn't exactly know, but we had reports of it working well to protect sheep herds in Europe. She let more silence pass, and then asked me if I owned a gun. I mentioned my newly acquired pump shotgun, and reminded her about the cracker shells and rubber slugs. "No," she said. "A real gun. A rifle. With bullets." When I told her I didn't own a rifle, she stared at me as though I had revealed a deep-seated, appalling vice. Looking down from the saddle, she fixed me with a hard, appraising glare. It got to me. For a moment I was ashamed to be a man of 23, presenting myself as a ranch hand, with just a shotgun to my name. As she watched me think this through, her face softened just a fraction. "I'll tell you what," she said. "If you need a gun, you call me." "Thank you," I replied. "I'll keep it in mind." "Do that," she said. "We'll get you what you need for the wolves." She spun her horse and rode away, leaving me among her family's cattle.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Bryce Andrews about his memoir, Bad Luck Way. You'll find this entire program online at mtpr.org/TWQ. We'll continue our conversation, and Bryce will read another passage from the book right after a short break. Stay with us. During your year at the ranch, wolves became a big problem, as they had before and as they have since. What happens when a landowner or manager identifies a wolf problem? What agencies and people get involved in that?
Well, it's actually a little bit different now than it was then, because when we were on the Sun Ranch, the wolves were still on the endangered species list. But the basic way it would unfold is that if a ranch manager or a ranch owner found that wolves were harassing or killing cattle, the first action would be to get in touch with, at that time, the first action would have been to get in touch with Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, and also and they in turn would contact the USDA's Wildlife Services Department, which that department both confirms kills and depredations and also often will trap and kill the wolves that did it. I think a manager has a choice when it comes to dealing with wolves in this situation. I think people can be flexible or they can be inflexible, but even flexibility has its limits because we're talking about making one's living from the land and oftentimes on many ranches making it on a very, very slim margin. So it becomes very complicated very quickly, but generally when wolves get in a pattern of taking cattle, we lose cattle and we lose wolves.
It goes back to that idea that the water is easier to get if you're just hanging around the creek all day. Why are the wolves going to chase down elk when they can just walk up basically to a cow?
Right. That's absolutely true. And sometimes, frankly, I'm surprised that wolves don't take more livestock than they do. I mean, for the most part, they show incredible restraint in not grazing close to the creek, as it were. They often do follow their natural prey and do stay away from livestock. But once the taking of livestock becomes a pattern, I think it's a really difficult thing to break without violence.
Mm-hmm. And that happened to you. The wolves started taking down the cattle. And so describe what happened once all those agencies came in and did their identifying work. Then what happened to you and what happened to the wolf?
Well, we made the decision that instead of doing what is often done in that case, which is pursuing the wolves through aerial gunning, through helicopters, that's what the departments often elect to do. We decided to we were issued 2 shoot-on-site permits for wolves after losing a number of heifers, and the manager of the ranch decided that we would try to fill them ourselves, which is to say the ranch hands would try to hunt the wolves, and the idea there was to pressure them on the ground and hopefully have a better chance of taking out wolves that were actually involved in the killing of cattle, not just wolves from the same pack, because our pack numbered 13 individuals. So as soon as the cattle began to die and those permits were issued, James and Jeremy, 2 of the guys I worked with on the ranch, began to hunt the wolves. I resisted it for a long time because of my upbringing, because of my inexperience with weapons and killing and my reluctance to do that. And then one day, I don't know, I think something changed. You know, I had seen a lot of heifers that I'd cared for and that I took responsibility for. I'd seen them torn up. And one day I went along, I had a borrowed rifle and honestly didn't expect to do anything with it. But I ended up running into a wolf and I ended up killing it, which was a very difficult thing for me and remains one.
It seemed like killing that wolf might have been some sort of a turning point in your life.
Yeah. I didn't go out there intending to cross that line. I think somebody told me a story way back about people sitting around a campfire and somebody goes out from the campfire into the darkness, does some crazy thing and returns with a story. And I think there's a part of me that looked at this experience as that. And I went into the dark and I did have some crazy stories, but I haven't returned. And I think that's related to what we're talking about. On the Sun Ranch, I came to understand that by virtue of choosing the work of ranching, I existed within the animal world, not beyond it. And that's a world full of beauty and brutality, and it's a world that has increase and death. Violence and compassion, those are both parts of it, parts almost in equal measure. And I think that one of the things that was so interesting about being there and being the person that I was with the background that I had is that I knew that the good side of that equation would be there, and I went there looking for it. You know, I went there to see the wolves as much as anything else. And what I found was the darker side of it And I found that it was necessary, and I was forced to engage with that. So I do think that changed my trajectory and changed the way I view my relationship with the natural, and particularly the wild world.
About the beauty and the brutality, there's a short passage in which you write about what you were thinking just before you left the ranch, and it involved that beauty and brutality. I'd like you to read that, starting on page 226. But first, tell us where you were and why.
Sure. Yeah, I can tell you about that. This passage that you asked me to read comes at the end of the book, and I had been sent by Roger, the ranch's owner, up to look at an old wolf den, one that had been used in years past. And Roger had this idea that maybe the wolves were using it again. And so I went up way before first light, and I was sitting in these little moundish hills watching this den, trying to see if wolves would go in or out of it. And I had a lot of time to think. I knew I was leaving the ranch. I knew that was coming down the pipe. And so, yeah, this is from that moment. Man marks landscape. He does it quickly, ubiquitously, and to such an extent in some places that it becomes impossible to tell what was there before he started. But a place also marks a man. I was born a Seattle boy, a water child who looked at the clouds through holes in the trees and at the sun through holes in the clouds. Seattle has an easy climate, provided you can stand the rain. The land is fertile. When I spat apple seeds on the ground and walked away, I expected trees to grow. Not so in the Madison Valley. Seattle tends toward soft, damp claustrophobia, but the Sun Ranch was characterized by exposure. A wide-skied place where everything but the hard essentials dried up and blew away. The valley and the ranch's two predominant qualities were beauty and brutality. That dual nature was in the weather. All summer, I watched thunderstorms roil along the horizon, blackening the sky like bruises. One day, a lightning bolt licked down and roasted a steer in his tracks. Duality was in the animals, too. There was nothing as eerily eloquent as the wedge pack's howling, and nothing messier than a kill. Waiting in the mounds for the emergence or arrival of wolves, I thought back to days and nights hunting them. The thrill of chasing big, dangerous creatures through close-set timber. The pinprick stars that kept me company at night, and the guilt I lived with after finally pulling the trigger. I shuddered to remember some of the work I did on the Sun. I had killed an elk, a deer, a wolf-maimed heifer, and the wolf that probably tore her up. Through the long, dark months of winter, those actions returned to keep me up at night. Often I was tempted to construe ranching as nothing more than a protracted act of violence. I thought hard about that until the sun rose high enough to light the faraway timber of the gravelly range. The temperature increased, and a handful of deer popped in and out of sight as they negotiated the close-set hills of the mounds. I took another look at the den's mouth, but found no motion there. Daylight began to warm the world, melting bits of snow on the sleeves of my coat. I watched jagged little crystals of ice subside into droplets one after another as the sun climbed my arm. As the drops soaked my jacket's canvas shell, they seemed to argue that on a place like the sun, things were always moving forward. Cattle got eaten. Wolves met bloody ends. Ranch hands arrived, sweated, and tried to stand against the wilderness long enough to make a living. Owners came and went, leaving their legacy in the form of strange structures and a mixed bag of place names. There was an element of tragedy in it, of course, but the main thing was that the land kept on. Day followed wild day, and over time amounted to a process of seasonal change. Immersion in that constant cycling was the ranch hand's highest privilege. The thought of summer coming on, the whole drama starting over with green grass, spotted fawns, and high expectations made it hard to think of leaving.
One of the biggest conundrums that I spotted in the book was that there is this cycle that you just read about, the cycle of animals on the land and then those animals being shipped off to be processed for people to eat. And yet we hide the processing of those animals far away in feedlots and in plants where nobody sees how they get into the little packages that end up in our grocery stores. So what did you think about eating meat and about that whole process by the time you came away from this particular phase of your life?
Well, it certainly brought me a lot closer to it and certainly makes it a more complicated thing when you sit down to a hamburger. And I'm using hamburger as an example for a reason, because we have developed a pretty darn efficient system of rendering an animal into something that's unrecognizable and, you know, at the lowest common denominator, taking parts of many, many different animals raised for the most part unscrupulously and blending them together. I can still eat meat. I still do eat meat. But I'll tell you, I have a really, really hard time eating meat if I don't know how the animals were treated and if I don't know where they came from. I've seen the entire process. After the Sun Ranch, I went on to run the Clark Fork Coalition's ranch in Deer Lodge for a number of years. And I raised cattle from birth, finished them, took them to Lolo Locker and watched them be killed and processed. I mean, I've seen the whole thing. And it's certainly difficult to embrace that, but I think I can accept it as long as the animals are treated well and as long as we honor what our relationship actually is with them. And it's the same way with the land, with the wild land. You know, the land and these animals, these are all we really have collectively. You know, in Montana, we are fortunate. If we're married in Montana, we are married to a beautiful and wild spouse. You know, our partner is the wild world. And we should understand that, and we should honor it. And similarly, when we sit down to a meal, you know, we should honor the origins of the thing we're eating. And I think that there's precious little of that getting done, and I'd like to see more of it.
The cattle that were on the ranch, the Sun Ranch, even though they were cared for and treated well as they could be while they were on the ranch, they still got loaded up in a truck and took a terrible ride somewhere, crammed into this truck, and then ended up in the processing plant.
They did, and we can do better. And, you know, this is one of the things that I continue to think about and work on. I mean, I just, a week ago, along with a friend, we worked up a lease on a ranch that's 5 miles outside of Missoula, and what we're going to do is raise cattle humanely. You know, we're going to raise them and finish them on grass and butcher them and sell them to people here in town. I think there are always going to be ethical complications with eating a creature that's as smart as a cow, because they're not that dumb. They're smarter than we think. They're more of an individual creature than we think. At the same time, I can do it as long as we're doing our best to do it right.
Bryce Andrews lives in southwest Montana, where he manages a conservation-oriented cattle ranch. Look for more information about him and his book, as well as links to our podcast and Facebook page at mtpr.org/twq. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.